Good afternoon and welcome to another episode of the Smart IT Podcast. And today, I'd like to introduce everybody to Melissa. Good afternoon, Melissa.
Hi, good afternoon. Thank you for having me.
Well, I love your background, so I'm feeling pretty good and in a good mood. So I appreciate what you got back there.
Thank you. Yeah, it's really what I stand for in life and in the workplace. When we can come from that place of unconditional love, I know that kind of sounds weird about the workplace, but really when we can come from that place, people feel it from us. And so I'm sure we'll talk about that today.
What's next for IT? In today's economy, technology touches every aspect of the day-to-day operations of business. There has never been more pressure on IT to deliver for our organizations. So what can we expect over the next decade? We need to think differently about how we approach our work to continue to thrive into the future. This requires all of us to be intentional in how we look at our role going forward. Smart IT is an approach to getting the important things done by transforming the way we think, work, and lead. And now, let's disrupt the status quo, simplify the complex, and reduce risk the Smart IT way. Well, on the Smart IT Podcast, we really want to treat the entire team as leaders who always upskilling their people skills to match their technical skills. So we always look for opportunities to bring people on to talk about leadership, communications, how do you present yourself, and then all those skills you need to really handle disruptions out in the marketplace, changes inside the organization. There's just a lot going on internally and externally to organizations. So it's one of those hallmark skills is, you know what, let me bring Melissa on here to talk a little bit about leadership and team building and how do you handle adversity. So I wanted to kind of start off first a little bit because in Smart IT Framework, we talk about purpose. So we always want to have the technical people kind of align themselves to what's the mission of the organization, whether it be nonprofit, for profit, in the regular corporations, big enterprise, or government. When you get up in the morning and go to work, we want people to have a sense of what's this mission of this organization that we're going through every day of work. So to kind of start there about aligning yourself with the organization that you work with.
Absolutely. Most companies will have a mission statement, a vision statement, and goals aligned to that. And the way I grew up in the workplace is, oh, you had it memorized, you had it down. So that meant that you knew it. But quite honestly, as I got into the company, I didn't really feel it inside. And so it wasn't until I really could align with the values and the beliefs did I really pick up on what the vision was of the company. And when I got to that place, I was unstoppable. It was almost like I was the CEO. And so I invite that of everyone. But for the leaders, those that are in charge of the mission and in charge of the programs and projects and products that are going on, be mindful of that. Your people, unless they can align to that mission and vision of the company, then it's upon you to figure out how to create that connection, not force it. You get to create it and evoke that out of individuals. And it's not really hard to do. And there's a Gallup poll statistics that have been evaluated over the years that look at the workplace engagement. These have been in place since 2000, and I've taken them for many years of my career. You know, how do you feel about your job? Do you like, you know, do you have friends at work? Those kinds of things. So yeah. As soon as people hear that, they're like, yeah, I get it. But those statistics have shown over the years that for a company, it's 20 to 30% people are actively engaged. And they're like I said, they're almost that CEO out in front. They can see the vision. Yeah. They're telling everybody the vision. They're driving the boat. And then you've got another 20 to 30 in the back of the boat, not only rowing the other way, but they're probably drilling a hole in the boat. So they're anti-vision mission. But you've got all that complement in between of people that I would call are disengaged, but they're persuadable. So if you're very intentional, if you're that leader or you're, you know, one of that 20 to 30% rowing the boat, you can really enroll people in that vision, just like the people drilling the hole can enroll that 50%. So it takes that intention to lean into, here's our vision, and you have a part of this. You were attracted to our company for a reason, for what we're doing, and you're staying here for a reason. And I think we can be intentional about that as leaders. But then you're just actually creating more leaders. Like you're empowering people to step, you're creating that space for them to step into their own leadership and go, okay, I can see where we're going. I can align to that.
Like I always tell people, you got out this morning, you went to work because of something that you and your colleagues and your organization, because of the efforts they put in, somebody somewhere is going to benefit from that. So it's even if you make a widget, there's somebody across the world that needs that widget to put in the machine that can make their city run, or is something to allow food to be delivered, or you know, just a myriad of things that we need in this modern life. So I think it's really helpful for people to think outside too. I'm just doing this one little task. Hey, it's not important. I got my paycheck. And like you said, if I'm in the back of the boat rowing, I'm like, I'm going to be rowing a different direction. And people in front say, don't do that. We need to get the widget out the door and shipped.
Absolutely.
Yeah. But I like what you said. You said the word persuadable. So that's a very interesting thing for leaders to hear that, right? There might be a large percentage of your team that doesn't believe in the purpose, but if they're persuadable, that means there's an opportunity for leaders then.
Absolutely. I mean, we all find our ability to align with something in the world. And it's really, that's why I tap on the leaders, but I do want to hit a nuance there. Yeah. I truly believe, and I think when we think in this way, a lot of people think leader, manager, they equate the two. However, we're expected to be leaders, you know, at least by 18, and we're being groomed to be a leader in our teenage years, taking responsibility, getting out of bed on time, getting ourselves dressed. I mean, that's all leadership skills. They may be, you know, minor in the bigger picture, but it's a bigger contribution to culture and everything that we're a part of. Well, then let's add to that. Did you become a parent? That's a leadership requirement. Are you caring for older parents? That's a leadership requirement. Are you holding different roles or commitments to a team? Probably so if you're working in a company. Same thing in your community. So there, that skill or title, even though it may not be official with a pay increase or anything like that, but you are effectively at least leading yourself. And I would say on a team, you have influences because you probably have a skill set or a trait where you're really, really good at something. And now, you know, it's really expected that you're going to help your other teammates and pull your weight. So all of that to me is a leadership trait and expectation when you're in the workplace and quite frankly, when you're an adult.
Yeah, and I like that because if everybody's looking around at each other and say, hey, I don't have a title and the boss just left the room, so we'll just wait for him or her to get back into the room. It's like, oh, that's not how things get done in the real world. Somebody has to be in the room at all times leading just to get the even simple things done.
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, there's, you know, I worked in engineering. There's so much of that role that you're working by yourself until you're not. You're part of that product goes to the bigger integration and test and, you know, making sure that we can deploy something that's safe, at least in the area that I came from. And I'm sure most places, right? But at that same time, I had to lead myself through that. Then I also had to meet time commitments, or I had to communicate if something wasn't going to be met. All that's a leadership skill. It's basic communications. You know, I may be adaptable. There's just different leadership skills in that we're bringing to the table when we come in to a team. And so I'll pause there. I could go on and on about being an individual leader.
Yeah, because I think that's what we need to kind of hammer home to everybody. Because like you said before about this title, some people, if they don't have the title, they're waiting. Well, I'll get there in 10 years. When I have the title, then maybe I might speak up more. And then maybe I might give more feedback. And then maybe I will go across departments and cross teams and then ask for more to get collaboration. And if you have enough of those people in the organization, then the entire team can be weighed down and you're missing opportunities all over the place. It's kind of one of those things that's festering organizations where people pointing fingers constantly and everybody waiting for the big cheese at the top to get this big old speech to fix everything. And it's like, you don't need to wait for that. There's opportunity now. Pick up the phone, walk around the cubicle, hit a chat and say, hey, I'm noticing things coming over to our team is missing something, or it looks different than it used to be. Can we have a conversation? So let's talk about those, like you said, every single day, those little opportunities to say, you know what, I need to change something because I'm seeing something that seems off here.
Absolutely. I'll share this. One of the things that I really like during COVID, and I know this is like may bring people like, no, we didn't like that at all. Yeah. But what I liked is we were doing everything on Zoom with our cameras on. And I worked in multiple large organizations where not everybody got a seat at the table, not by design. It was just the table was small. So what that led to is oftentimes people that weren't at the table wouldn't speak up. It's almost like they weren't maybe even in the room, or there was times when we had teleconferences, you didn't even see people. Yeah. So if you weren't quick to the draw, you weren't getting that conversation. What I loved being that leader of a team is I could see everybody's face. I could see their expressions. And if somebody kind of made a reaction to something I said, I would say, hey, I'm seeing something's coming up for you. Do you mind sharing? And I would at least give them the stage. So the point being, what I liked during that time is everybody got a front row seat. And everybody then had more of the likelihood and the opportunity to contribute than we would have if we were in a conference room or maybe even on the phone, which is how we did it way back in the day. And so everybody just got that opportunity to weigh in. And I do think when we are part of, back to that leadership concept, when we are part of a team, we actually have a moral obligation to contribute. So if we see something, I mean, we see that motto in school, see something, say something, or at the airport, see something, say something. I would say the same thing about the workplace, because there are plenty of studies that communicate how much better we are together as a workforce and a team working together than the one lone individual. And then I want to touch on that leader, the big cheese that you talked about. Sure, they were smart. Sure, they were talented enough to get, you know, to know enough, but they're not the smartest in the room. What they probably have a trait of is they know how to align people and how to work together. Let's hope. That's what they've got. But, you know, really, they're not meant to be the smartest in the room, typically. It's everybody's contribution makes us all a collective smart. And then hopefully they're smart enough to be able to communicate for the team. But, you know, that's not always the case either. So I just share that because I think there's a perspective around a role, like we could say about the president right now. Here's all that they bring to the table, but maybe not. And so when you create a team, you're aligning. This is how I loved curating high performance teams, as I could see people's besides like what they put on paper, but also how they worked, like what are their good traits? Yeah. Where do they have gaps? And then I put the puzzle together and it was masterful. And in that masterpiece, I did expect and really created the environment where everybody got to contribute. And we were able to do massive projects to get big things out the door that were nationwide, and actually I would say North America wide implementations, but it took everybody playing their part 110%, or, you know, sometimes people were 80, but we performed quite high. Yeah. But we had that inner accountability, the expectation that everybody was communicating and bringing their part, and we really showed that at the end of the day. So, you know, I think that's what's needed in organizations. And when somebody says leadership, don't close your ears or shy away because you don't have a title.
Yeah, and I like that whole Zoom analogy you're using. Because think about on Zoom, you can put the virtual hand up. So if it's 1,000 people on the Zoom call and you scan it, you can see the hand like this. But if you're in person, you know, scanning the auditorium, it might be hard to catch somebody.
Yeah, and if you're in an auditorium and you're on a stage, the lights are so bright, you can't see past the first three rows anyway. Yeah. or not even hear people because they're not on a microphone. So I thought it was a great, I'm short. Can I tell you that? I'm 4'11". You met me in person.
Yes.
But it was a great equivalator. Is that a word? You know, we were all equal on the screen. You couldn't tell weight. You couldn't tell height. You couldn't tell, I mean, we can tell color, but it created a lot of equalness that I felt as a leader because, again, everybody had a front row seat, but none of those other shy away factors really contributed for the most part in my perspective. So, and what if we could live the world that way? So that's where the unconditional love comes for me. And I don't mind, or I don't hope you don't mind if I already go there, but to me as a leader, People are going to mess up, period. They are. If I'm the leader that comes from unconditional love, I know they're going to mess up and I care enough about their results to support them in growing from that experience, not crushing them. Now, obviously, I've got to know my tripwire because there's always I'm not going to look bad threshold. Now, if you are a leader in a role, you need to push that out. I'm just going to tell you now, a lot of people have it so close that there's no, like, nothing can go wrong because I don't want to look bad ever. Well, if you took that role on, sorry, you've signed up for something different. So push that threshold, but know it. Keep your team members in that boundary, but give them the opportunities and care about them enough to support them. If something does go bad, it's like, okay, how do we learn from this? What would we do different? And support them, don't crush them. Because at the end of the day, when people get crushed, they're going to stop being a leader altogether. They're going to stop showing up that way. And so that's why I bring what I say, unconditional love, into the workplace, not in a weird way, but just in that way that I care about every single team member enough to see them succeed.
Yeah, and when you think about it, that's a mistake by an individual is feedback, right? And it's a potential learning experience for others. So that one mistake by one person could have been made by 10 other people, but no one saw it. And they're in the background like, oh my God, hope no one notices I did the exact same thing. So if the leader took the opportunity to treat that as feedback, and then, like you said, build up the person, they could be talking to not just one person, but those other 10 people in the background. And that makes them feel even better.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that's a culture thing too. I mean, you know, there's so many cultures that are still punitive to this day. I mean, I thought we were kind of evolving out of it. But what I started to see in my organization, they would say that, but the results weren't that. And granted, at the end of the day, if we did really bad, there was loss of life. So we did our best to never, ever, ever get there. And we really didn't. And at the same time, people would mess up we would get close on certain things, and we had a process that you would walk through to make sure that we looked at it. What went wrong? What could we do better? Did we miss a procedure? And that was the idea or goal, is to correct something like that and to avoid being so punitive that this person shows up worse the next day. Because at the end of the day, if the human's not good, it doesn't mean that we're going to do any better in the overall result of what we're doing. It'll affect our outcome. So, you know, that was the idea, but I would say culture really weighs in. And so if you are a leader that has a title or a team member that really cares, I pay attention to culture because we can change that. It's just not easy if we let it fester on and on and on.
And if you had the right type of leadership culture and you feed upon it on that, I mean, every person in a 1,000-person company or 10,000-person company or 100,000-person organization, that multiplies, right? And that culture is constantly being reinforced every single day. So if you mess up and go off for a couple of weeks and everything's getting kind of negative inside and maybe productivity is going down, there's still opportunity for literally everybody in the organization to kind of turn it around by their voice, their tone, you know, let me pull you to the side. So I think sometimes we lose track of the amount of opportunities we have on a daily basis to turn something around.
Oh, for sure. Could you imagine? So if we use that statistic that we were talking about before, and you've got now 80% of the boat actively engaged in the vision and then the goals, quite frankly, that other 20-30%, they're either so annoyed by these others, they're too, you know, they've got love on their wall, they're too, and they choose out, or they are also influenced. And so now you've got an organization that turns out to be 90-95%, and I've seen it. I've created it in my world. When you have that, culture is a leading guide for everybody. And now you've got that 100,000, many thousand company, everybody showing up like a CEO. Like, they know that the end result is going to be amazing, and they take ownership in that. That makes a big difference in the bottom line, internal relationships, the profitability of the company. And at the same time, just like home influences work, vice versa, work influences home. So there's other added benefits, right? I mean, your whole life just elevates.
And when you wear that logo on the shirt, people say, why are you so happy, man? It's Monday's coming up. It's the start of a new week. So what are you so optimistic about? Well, I'm going into an organization where I feel valued and seen. And it's a joy to go there, do something bigger than myself, get paid very well versus, oh man, I really don't want to see Monday. It's just going to be dreary. And you can almost pick that up, right? It's like, there's something going on over there. Can I get hired over there? So that's the kind of feel you really want to hear about as leaders.
Absolutely.
Now, I know a lot of time when we think about these opportunities to build this culture, it really comes in handy when hard times hit. So maybe the macroeconomics are starting to turn downward. Maybe the numbers are going down. And one of the most common things that leaders have to face who got the official title is what happens when the numbers aren't where they should be. And I think we've gotten to the very bad habit of pull reduction in force button at just the shortest sign of trouble. We got to make sure the numbers look good for external stakeholders. Yeah. I think everybody went to the same conference years ago where they're pulling this trigger. It's like, whoa, what's going on here? And when they have to do that, all of a sudden people started to question the culture. And it's like, hey, I thought we were working together. Why aren't you sharing some of these things with us? So I think if you have the right positive culture and things are open, you understand, okay, conditions are getting worse. How can we do something else besides, you know, let's let 10% of our colleagues go? So let's talk about having this culture and strong leadership when things aren't going so good.
Absolutely. And that's one of the best times to have a culture that is in that unconditional love, allows people to be authentically themselves. And you know, and for the leader that can see that, that's amazing. One of the things that I'll just use as an example, being a manager, if you're not connected with your employees well enough and somebody starts showing up late, or maybe they've always showed up late, and you're not willing to have a conversation that gets curious, like we always go in for corrective. Yeah. And I almost hate that word, like crucial conversation or corrective, like, with the first conversation always gets to be as curious. So if I'm curious, hey, I'm seeing William, you're showing up late. Is something going on? Is there something that I can support you with? And the conversation evolves to, well, you know, my kids are now in school and they don't start till 8:30. And I used to be able to get here at 8:00, and I'm a single parent, or my wife is in the at the hospital and she has to report at 6:00. So I have child duty in the morning and she has child duty in the afternoon. I can't make 8:00 anymore. So I would love to request a shift in my schedule. Well, you know, one could think, well, why did William not ask that? Well, if the whole culture is everybody shows up early or you're, you know, labeled lazy, well, what's going to make William ask?
That's a good point. And everything has a cause and effect there. It goes downstream.
I was going to say, I worked in an organization that we supported the whole continental and non-continental U.S. So we had Hawaii as well in that, which is one of the furthest time zones we supported. And then we had the East Coast. And so we're on call all of that time where our services are operational. So that's a significant amount of time. Yeah. So we needed early birds and we needed late birds and we needed everything in between. Now, as the leader, the only thing I would say is I got to find the balance, which was primarily in the mid-morning or early afternoon where people were at their best. And I got to check in with that so that if I was asking people to do something that had a heavy push, I knew when they were showing up in their best way. And when they were showing up in their best way, they were going to bring forward, you know, their best result. But at the same time, if I'm an early bird, I can't dislike or make a label about the people that aren't, because they're pulling their weight way later than I do. I just know I shut down at 2:00 and then we get started at 2:00. There's nothing wrong with that, especially when your organization may operate like ours did, where it was, you know, pretty much starting at 4 or 5 a.m. and going till 11 on the furthest time zone that we were supporting. I mean, that's, you know, no one's supporting that whole time window.
And that's understanding the system in the end. What's the mission? What's our team structure? What is our organization capabilities? So we have that flexibility. Like you said, if you know someone's coming in late, or if you just hear, yeah, such and such just had their first son, well, that will trigger you even without you having to think about, hey, they may need some more support. You could actually proactively address that, or just, like you said, check in, just to find out, because you know what things that happen, because maybe you yourself had the exact same experience. So it's like the humanity of it is, we're all talking about people here. So you know some of the commonalities or challenges and what might affect their ability to show up. And even noticing somebody not as a supporter or as, call it, outgoing, you may notice the differences because you care. And I think, bottom line, I think for most stakeholders should want this because it actually affects the bottom line. It helps support the ability to deliver for your shareholders and then make almost an unstoppable organization. And I think sometimes from the outside, people like they crunch your numbers and don't see it. They say input, output, just get it to me.
For sure. And productivity really matters because even if you don't do a reduction in force, or whether you do, there's an energy around what's going on in the world, you know? So even if it's not affecting directly your company, it's affecting the humans inside. It's affecting their families and the extension of their families. And so that worry comes in, well, that affects productivity. Now, if somebody can actually get away from the outer world by coming to work, you brought up Mondays. A lot of people call it the miserable Mondays. Yeah. What if we thought about it like Millionaire Monday? That's where we make our millions based on how we start Monday. Yes. And we're excited and we create it. You know, the results are going to differ. And sometimes that influences, or a lot of times it does, influences at home, and we can weather the storm. You know, really just how we show up and how we believe allows us to weather the storm versus, oh, great, it's the Mondays, you know. And now energy is a big deal. You know, again, I would go back to that unconditional love. If I show up loving where I care, I'm creating a brighter energy that can kind of override some of the other things that would show up at work. And as a leader, I would always invite that. If you show up grumpy and you see the lack of energy in your workforce, then there's probably something that you should shift, because the world is a mirror. It's like, it's as simple as that. A lot of people think the world is tough, people are tough. They are not. It is super simple. When you look at it as a mirror, it's like, oh, well, what can I shift? I showed up grumpy today and my team is grumpy. What do I get to do to shake that off? You know, the two easiest way to shake something off?
Oh, what's that? What you got?
Sing and dance. I know that feels weird. You may not want to do that at the workplace, but maybe go in your car and just, you know, even if you get to like not sing out loud like we would in the shower, but, you know, sing with your earbuds on in your car for a second, that's an energy shift. You're moving emotions through you. It's an energy shift. So it's a simple way. Take a walk around the building, get outside, another way to get into nature and really enjoy it. And gratitude is probably another way. I didn't expect to go into this list, but I am. Gratitude, like when you're walking the building, just look for things to be grateful for. I'm grateful for the green grass. I'm grateful. And say it out loud, because you're connecting. When you acknowledge that it in that way, you're connecting. Same thing if I was to acknowledge someone in a grateful way. Like, here's something we could all do right now. If you were to pick up your phone, the first person that comes to mind, send them a grateful text. Like, hey, you are on my heart. You know, every time I think about you, I remember this one time we were together, and you just made me feel seen, and I really appreciate that. And I try to do that with others. And then don't expect anything in return, but just sit and receive. You'd be surprised, because when we're in gratitude, it shifts everything. So I gave you a couple of ways to just really quickly shift. But if we are the leader, or we are an influencer in our team, there's real easy ways to shift it when it's not going the way that it should. Now let me caveat that. Yeah. If somebody's dealing with something, let them have their emotion, even if it makes you uncomfortable, like a loss of life, a disease diagnosis, you know, something like that. Let them have their emotions so they can get it through. Because as Americans, we tend to stuff. Yeah. And that comes up as disease or illness. And so, you know, let them have their space if they need it. Sometimes you get to hold the bucket and not try to fix it. Yeah. So I do want to say that before I say, here's how we can shift the energy. Yeah. Yes, we can shift it. But sometimes people get to have their time if something big is going on in their life.
And you have to show that by example. So if the people see the CEO maybe spending 10 minutes walking around, they won't think that person's crazy or weird or something. Or like, how can that person out of work? He just walked around. And then the next person, like, hey, you know what? I could use 5 to 10 minutes as well. I'm not saying, hey, that's not break time. What are they doing? It's like, they must be going through something. Let it go. Continue working and come back. Are you doing all right? Let's continue on. And that just reinforced that culture, because that makes the entire organization more resilient. Because there's always going to be challenges, internal and external. Mm-hmm. Now, Melissa, yeah. I had a cool example in the past. I had two examples of reduction of forces, maybe like 10 years ago, and then maybe like 8 years ago, where they actually were proactive, where they let everybody know up front that something might be coming down the pipe. And they gave us a leeway, where there's enough time to, you know, to prep, you know, what's going to happen on that day, so you can prepare personally. And I appreciated that. I think right now the problem is when you do it so quickly, right? So you're hearing these signals in the market, and then you're asking questions of your manager. They said, don't worry, we're good. Keep your head down. And all of a sudden, they start to put these new performance metrics out. They start to little hint that something's going on, but they won't acknowledge it. And then you get that notification that says, hey, there's a 15-minute invite for the next morning, but you got it at 8 o'clock at night, which is like, oh, wow, this is how it ends. And all of a sudden, it could have been better if you could have let people know ahead of time. Like what you're saying is, we really don't trust you, so we got to shorten the window before we let you know. And you had to go back to your family and tell them just abruptly, as opposed to saying, in 4 to 6 weeks, something's about to happen, and then I can do something about that. So let's talk about this. Humanity, it's not a problematic. We don't guarantee you employment, but if we're on the team and we have more heads up that something bad might happen and it might affect 5 to 10%, there is in power and scope of power for leaders with titles to actually make that more humane. So let's talk about that a little bit.
Of course. And you're hitting on one that I experienced earlier this year with my team members. And we were hearing whispers of it, but the managers didn't even really hear before it happened. We heard from our employees when they got an email at midnight the night before. So there was a lot of emotions for me, because I got the opportunity to hire a lot of people over many years, and I knew how many were impacted. And I'll jump ahead. I saw someone later in my career. They're in a different generation. And the only reason I bring that up is because I noticed this generation tends to be a lot more empathetic and purpose-driven. So they really align with organizations where they feel their purpose is being served. So they don't necessarily feel a loyalty to need to stay around if they don't see themselves in that vision and in that purpose. Mm-hmm. And one of these individuals, we were in a class together, and they said, you know, I was let go due to a reduction in force. And I get it, because the company just didn't have the money and I was able to go on and find my purpose in this other XYZ. And I'm like, well, that's very, wow, admirable that you feel that way, because I wouldn't. I would feel hurt, because a lot of times we do align and create a loyalty to an organization. So the reason I bring that up is because your employees, people find a loyalty. There's many that still do to an organization, even if they're actively disengaged, like we talked about. Yeah. And the rug is pulled out from under them, and all of a sudden they're now in the surge. Not a lot of people have a stockpile of money saved up for the rainy day. Our inflation, yeah. I'll get that word out, yeah. isn't supportive of it right now for many people. And so that's a big hit to the ego, to the pocketbook, to the survival. Like, that creates a lot of energy that I would say is not necessarily needed and could be prevented if we saw employees like human beings, equal partners in the result. However, I'm going to go maybe in a bit extreme place. A lot of people, employers, may think, I own you, you're property of mine, which is not true. What if we didn't think that way? Yeah. If we thought of the you know, oh my gosh, William brings XYZ to the table, you know, he's always this in the room, or, you know, whatever it is. And we saw each individual as the individual they are, we wouldn't have those late night emails or 15-minute, everybody get in the room, here's an envelope. If it says this, you choose to go to another team, or if you don't, you're gone. And you got to make a big life decision in 15 minutes in front of a room with tears going down your face, and at least in my case. So I think we've got to see, you know, really tap back into the humanity of everybody that's working for this. Whether you're a peer with someone, you're a manager leading, you're a CEO, like everybody that is contributing to the bigger picture, is a human at the end of the day, and they have feelings, even if they don't always show it. And they actually have loyalty, whether you don't see it or not, most likely. And so I would afford them the opportunity to, like you say, to lead up to it. Hey, we are going to have to do reduction in force. Here's how we're going to think we go about it. And your best people may choose out, but you know what? That's fair. That's fair in this game. You know, they may see the writing on the wall and they know that they're very valuable and can just, you know, make the same money elsewhere. Okay, so give them a chance. But we don't play that game that way typically. We feel like we own all the chess pieces until we choose out for them. And, you know, that does not create loyalty to the people that stay behind and the people that go. It doesn't at all. Because the people that stay behind, they have that event in their head and they may wait for the opportunities, but their loyalty is probably, there's probably a big chip or crack in that loyalty.
Yeah. And so, and it's such a lot of missed opportunities there, because we hired, if it's a 100-person firm, we hire each of the 100 people for a specific reason. So if we know that we gotta let 5 of them go. But in some cases, you see a couple of weeks later, there's a new posting on the company site for a new hire, and you got the new positions open. And somebody may be looking like, hold, you just let me go. So you say you're short on money. Is it a role I could have done? No one asked me, could I reskill or do it? I never given the opportunity. So as a leader who looking at all these skill sets and capabilities and looking 6 months out, 9 months out, a year, I think they may be afforded more opportunities to treat this differently, because it's very hard to one find new talent and bring them on board. So if it takes 6 months to get somebody really working in your organization and your organization's on mission, which is infinite, right? It's no company said, you know, we're going to be around for about 5 years and then we're going to exit out. Now, the venture capitalists will act like that, but that's not the mission, because we need great talent and great people for a great team over an infinite period of time. So we're going to go for 100 years. So I would rather just do some shifting around to keep this talent, as opposed to cycling every couple of years, the people in and out, reorganizing it, changing, giving some weird names, bringing outside consultants in and say, you know what, we're going to do it something differently. And the people left can be looking like, I think we used to do that already. You just changed the name of that. What? And then you lose that trust there. And it's just a sad state of affairs, I think, with far too many companies.
And you'd be surprised if you would involve the employees in a restructure. You'd probably create something that you would have never imagined. Because oftentimes, if you are looking from above, you don't have the intricacies of all the inner workings of the processes. And, you know, who has a magical skill set that doesn't really show up on their performance job description, you know, those kinds of things. And there may even be some employees to go, you know, I love this work so much, I would take a 20% pay cut to stay here and refocus, you know, and, you know, with knowing that I have the opportunity to grow. But the, you know, we have a sunk cost in the investment that we've made in people to learn the tools, to learn the processes, you know, maybe even to build certain things. So I say, when you can invite them into the conversation, you're going to come up with a far better result. And it may be just one little tweak to get you where you need to be. And some of that little tweak could, you know, outperform your competitors, could be the one little thing that was missing for your stakeholder that you're, you know, you're creating this widget for, whatever it is. So I would always say, invite the team in the best you can to say, hey, look, we've got to cut costs. Let's talk about it. And sometimes it doesn't necessarily have to be with people. We can find out a better, more innovative way to do something, like getting rid of a certain cut software that we're using, or a testing platform, or, you know, we've maybe been on the cutting edge of something that we could do that we haven't done yet. So I think there's just plenty of opportunities. And, you know, morale and culture is something that you cannot overcome. Because once you start creating something different, it sticks around for a long time. It's, you got to be very intentional from start to end when it comes to culture and morale, always.
And that got me thinking about that. You mentioned the like taking a 20% pay cut, or some people may say, I'm going to go part-time so I can keep the benefits, right? That's a lot of the big thing, is the benefits. Or maybe, can I do help out as an external consultant? So just imagine all these different things we're listing here of alternative. So, okay, now the numbers look better 9 months later. Now we can start hiring again. What? And you get a reorg again. And all this constant change and motion. But I think something that's on top of a lot of people's minds today, Melissa, so we've been talking about all the people. Now we're going to talk about all the robots here that people are been very in tune to with AI. And I find it interesting is they're trying to push AI to each individual person on the planet at the same time and just go wild. I'm like, this is insane. The organization has a culture, it has a structure. And normally when new technology comes aboard, it goes through IT, they have business analysts, we got change agents, organization change management. So we got a lot of different things to bring in change on a very measured way. In this case, it seemed to be everybody just saying, everybody just hop online and just start to do something. It seems crazy. And of course, the scaring people were saying, okay, is the robot going to be faster than 10 of my people? What does that mean for me? So let's talk about leaders who got the title, who's looking at this and they thinking, oh my God, I can save so much more money with cost and cutting. And that's their mindset as opposed to how can I help our existing people team, our skills to be more productive and sell more things out there.
Absolutely. So I'll start this out with, I'm a physicist by training and then originally trade. So engineering background. AI is exciting to me just from that flat basis. Yeah. However, I think when it comes to working in a team, there's always intention on what are we here to do? So at the end of the day, if we're here to keep people alive, safety, like whatever it is, we've got to know our intention before we ever step into anything new to include AI. Now, 2 weeks ago, Monday, I wrote a whole book in a day. I've been working in ChatGPT for a long time. It knows my personality by the projects and things that I've done with it. And I've learned how to interview. So it's almost like my bestie that's remembered everything I've done. And when we're talking, it's being able to craft some of my thoughts better than I can do it because my thoughts are fleeting. They're in and out, in and out, in and out. Whereas the bot, if you will, is not fleeting. But what it doesn't have emotions. It doesn't have morals. It doesn't have. So if any of that is like maybe a falter for me, it's going to show up in the output just based on my conversation, my interviewing, that kind of thing. And that's to me what AI can't do. And I think as a country, as a world, we should really decide where that threshold is. Because if you think about some of the political decisions that are going on today, we don't all have the same view, values, beliefs, and morals. That's why there's varieties of religions. That's why there's, you know, different policies in different countries. Those aren't all the same. Well, the bot just brings the best of everything together and gives a result. And then you've got to check in on that result. So to me, the big picture of that is what is the intention of that we're here to create? Because we can get there faster. We can brainstorm faster. We can test faster with something like that. So it's an enhancement, but it's not a replacement. And I don't think it will be for a while until we get through some of this, or we may regret it being a total replacement because the human at the end of the day has enough morals to say, we don't want people to die. Yeah. We don't want people to get diseased or sick, you know, whereas the bot has do X, I'm going to do X at all costs.
Yeah. But I think there's one thing, a very important thing people are missing, especially leaders around the world. They're very excited about containing costs is just like you mentioned religion. So if somebody goes into church today and don't like what the preacher says, what do? They leave and go to the next church down the street. If you don't like the political party, what do? You leave and go to the next one. So there's always choice. The human is actually making choices. So what happens when you go to your bot and two people go to the same bot, ask a question, one likes the answer and the other one doesn't like the answer. Mm-hmm. The person who doesn't like the answer can go to a different bot. And if they don't like the answer, they will keep searching to the bot to give them the answer. So I think people might be expecting too much, especially like say the CEO asked the bot a question about strategy and the bot tells the CEO that they should take a 50% pay cut and the CEO doesn't like the answer. He's going to have to either change the bot or have something change on that one. So what happened when the people gatekeepers, right, the human aspect, doesn't like the answer. I think right now we're just assuming it's the bottom population that's going to take the brunt of it. And then these leaders may wake up one day and find out the bot gave me an answer I didn't like. So maybe the bot owner, who's all excited today, you know, you're going to ChatGPT and see all excited until it comes out and say, hey, this is not good for humanity or the bottom line. We think you should shut down your company. He's going to look at it and say, you know what? We're going to have to reprogram you to give me the answer I want. So let's talk about this. People are assuming this one great answer gives the right answer to everybody that they want to hear.
Well, the thing is you're working in ChatGPT and me working in my ChatGPT. So I've curated my own best friend that's going to make me feel good about myself. You have too. And we probably have and somewhere along the way, different views, different perspectives, different cultures, you know, all that kind of stuff. So the answer that we get asked the same exact question, the answer you get and I get are going to be different. Now, if we ask a factual thing, like when did da-da-da happen, we're probably going to get the same answer. But when it comes to designing, innovation, art, we're all going to create a different outcome. And that's okay. And that's where, to me, a ChatGPT or a bot or AI is not the end-all be-all. Can it help me get my ideas out there faster, get them on paper? Oh, yeah. But at the same time, at the end of the day, when we're trying to make a decision on safety of life or whatever it is, and I use safety of life just because that's extreme, but when we're trying to make a decision at the end of the day, we still need the curated team to come together and say, you know, considering all the factors and the risks and the cost, here's the direction we're going to go. Because if we do not do that, then my bestie, because we're using my bot, yeah, is going to be the one with the answers, and it may not be the best answer for the company. So I think right now the human still matters. Now, there may be a time in the future, but that may be when the rest of us are all numbed out, or maybe it's the result doesn't necessarily matter at the end of the day as far as life is concerned or whatever. So I still believe there's a human element necessary. I just do believe when it comes to processes and me getting things out of my head and written eloquently to where I can communicate it with someone else, by all means, leverage that. But then, you know, have the team each do their own research, bring it together. And, you know, we kind of get back to the day where we debate concepts. Okay, well, we've got A, B, or C. Considering all the factors, what do we think collectively as a team? Well, now this is where it's hard for technical people. So I'll go there. Technical people at the end of the day are going to do their research. So if you manage a technical person and you're not, listen up. Yeah. They're going to do their research to come up with what they think is the best solution. So they are going to stand in their everything for that best solution. So keep that in mind. Sometimes to the death. And I know that sounds extreme, but so when you're managing someone like that, you've got to be able to curate team members working together to help them see each other's solution as a possibility. Because oftentimes if you've researched, you won't see any other solution because you want your solution to win. There's a competitiveness to that. There's a judgment to that, but we don't want to treat people that way. So if you're managing someone like that, just be mindful of how to have these kinds of people work together, because they're very good at their job and getting to a solution. They may not be good with people. So you've got, it all matters. So you've got tactical situations and you've got adaptive situations. You've got widget situations. You've got people situations. And those aren't led the same and treated the same. But back to AI, I really am excited because, like I said, I wrote a book on a Monday 2 weeks ago. Now, where I'm struggling, where AI and I are not on the same page, is formatting it. So now I got to go back to School of Hard Knocks and format in Word. This is a header. This is a, you know, yes, what I mean? And it's the same thing with a picture, because when it creates a picture, that it doesn't know that there's words in the picture anymore. Put a picture in and say, leave it alone, and it recreates the picture and the words in it don't even look like words. So it's not perfect, and I don't know that it will be for a while. And there's a good book, I have to remember what it's called, but it was on Audible, and it talked about how AI was created. It's a big eye-opener, because when you see that, then you would realize, okay, so yes, this is a very time-saving tool, but it's not the end-all be-all, and I don't think it will be for a while. Yeah, there's a lot of things these robots can be very humanistic More so than they've ever been. But it's not going to replace everything that a human can be, to include the emotions and feelings that actually support us being innovative and creative in finding the best solution.
Yeah, and I think it's important for leaders to make sure they level set properly. I think some companies are going way into the cost cutting so much, they're ignoring the mission, they're ignoring the people. And the smart ones are saying, okay, how can we help alleviate some of the challenges our people are having with this new technology, which includes AI, which makes for an entirely different dynamic. Then you get excited, like, there's something I'm doing over and over, it's rote tasks over and over again. We can enhance what we can do in this process, which help lead upstream to like delivering value to our customers faster. And that seemed to be the proper way to actually think about it. But yeah, I'm seeing a lot of companies just rushing left and right, and they're thinking about just numbers and headcount and things like that.
Well, and there's one other fact that I'd like to add to that. So think about it, at the end of the day, as a company, you are still responsible for your product, for the impact that it has. So if you don't have the testing or the design process or anything behind how you made a decision, and you just totally rely on AI and you try to skirt that accountability, that doesn't work. Yeah. If your product takes someone's life, you are still responsible. The sad thing is now, can you even track it if a bot is doing all of your processes, all your decisions, and you're not even part of it? So that's the part that worries me, in a sense. If where's our accountability? How do we know if our product was the failure that created, you know, this result that we didn't want? But we're still responsible. It's our product.
That's going to be fascinating. I'm just imagining now a CEO saying, "Your Honor, it was not my fault. It was the bot."
We're already seeing it. I won't name any names, but we are already seeing it.
Yeah. It used to be you just to say it's the research team or the marketing team's fault, or it was Joe down in engineering. It was Joe's fault that this doesn't work. Now he has to just say it was Gemini or ChatGPT. It was their fault. And people just looking at this like, bots or people, you're still responsible. Assume the accountability for it. So as you bring in new technology, just to be aware of that. And I just know we're going to have more and more cases where people are going to offload responsibilities to the technology, and as opposed to watching what the technology is doing, understanding why it's giving you the answer it's giving you, and make sure someone asked you about it, they can tell you did the work on it, right? It wasn't something that was just given to you and you have no idea what it was.
Yeah, for sure.
So, is there anything we haven't covered? Because I love this leadership topic, because it's the culture, the accountability. I mean, it's just fascinating, just the areas we could go into. Anything we haven't touched on that you'd like to bring up?
No, but I think just to really sum up the whole leadership picture, I would say the sooner you step into your own leadership and really come from a place of the end result, I am responsible for it no matter what, which is a huge level of leadership if you follow John Maxwell. But when you can come from that place, and then think about, like, what is my stand? What am I standing for? How am I showing up in the world to create that? I feel like everything else becomes free and flowing, because now you're very intentional about how you show up, how you live your life, how am I aligning with this company, and even the course correction. Because I will say, as a leader, when I knew in that crucial conversation that at the end of the day it was about changing behavior, I wasn't going in thinking I'm going to fire Joe. I was going in thinking, okay, what's going on with Joe that I need to figure out, and how can we both create a correction so that Joe is, you know, gainfully employed here? And I don't, there really was no Joe, but I'm using Joe as a name. He can be gainfully employed. Yeah. That was my responsibility as a leader. It was not about, oh my gosh, he's bad, let's fire him. But a lot of people go with that approach. If we can all show up in that level of leadership, everything flows so much better. The employees work better together, and we create that culture that is 90 to 95% actively engaged, as though they are the CEO, and working in the workplace just becomes really simple.
I love that, Melissa. So even without the title, anybody in any organization, anywhere in life, can scan their environment, scan their world, take it all in, look for opportunities, and they can lead the change that they need. So I think that's pretty powerful that everybody should take away from this. Yeah, let's hear it.
So the book that we wrote, I'm part of Team Excellence, where we actually focus on creating 10 out of 10 culture in the workplace, creating 10 out of 10 relationship with profit and results, and of course, the people you work with. Well, the book is called The ABCs of Leadership, and my dog is excited about it. And it's actually a workbook. So we go through 26 different behaviors on how to show up as a leader, and then you get to research with, like, okay, great. So how does accountability, that's A, how am I being accountable? And it's a reflection exercise so that I can figure out how I'm showing up. So over the next several months on LinkedIn, you can find me, Melissa Marks. We're going to be previewing chapter by chapter as we publish. So we'd love to have people along on the journey.
Okay. Well, we'll definitely include some links in the show notes for everybody can check that out.
Okay. And I apologize about my dog. He's excited about the book.
All good. I'll look forward to that.
Yeah. Awesome.
Well, I appreciate your time today, Melissa. It's been engaging conversation, and I think my audience will really appreciate it.
Thank you. It was a pleasure to be here.
All right. With that, we're going to close out another episode of the Smart IT Podcast. Until next time, take care. Thanks for joining another episode of the Smart IT Podcast, where we explore what's next for IT and disrupt the status quo, simplify the complex, and reduce risk together. If you like what you hear, please like, subscribe, and leave your comments. And for more Smart IT wisdom, check out my website at williamreed.info.